Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Alchemist Lounge. As always, I'm your host, Alex Atwood. And as you know, this is a space where we dive deep into the minds of high performers and leaders and learn all about the alchemy that fuels their journey. And today, I'm very excited to introduce a very special guest. She is someone who has transformed the world of corporate human resources, and she's also on the leading edge of the evolution of what leadership means. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Her name is Susan Schmidt-Winchester. She's currently Senior Vice President of HR at a company called Applied Materials, which is a global Fortune 500 company with more than 25,000 employees. But she's not just a corporate executive. She's also an advocate for workplace wellness. And we love having conversations about wellness, specifically in the workplace. And she's an author of a book called Healing at Work. And I just absolutely love that title. I absolutely love what she's up to. Susan's career trajectory and her insights in creating healthy, productive workplace environments have made her a leading voice. And I am so happy to welcome her to the Alchemist Lounge. How are you today, Susan?
Alex, thank you. I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for the intro. It's fabulous.
Thank you. Well, thanks for your time on the show. So let's start off. Could you share a little bit about your journey moving through the corporate ladder and eventually leading to healing and growth?
Well, I guess the best place to start is that I have been in the corporate HR world basically for 35 years. And I've worked with some amazing, very well-known companies through all those years. And I've really been very fortunate to have had a lot of great experiences, including the last nearly 16 as chief HR officer for two of those Fortune 500 companies. And I think what's important to note about that is, you know, while you look at my career and my resume, you think, oh, you know, it's pretty impressive, some good accomplishments. What people don't know is that the majority of those accomplishments, the majority of my career, was all fueled by an underlying belief that I wasn't good enough. And my behavior and how I went to work was to show up every day trying to prove myself, going home at the end of the night, feeling like I had failed, and giving myself a D on my performance review, my daily performance review. And always second guessing everything I'd done. Did I say the right thing, or I shouldn't have said this, or I should have done that? And then feeling stressed and anxious about it. And then unfortunately, I used alcohol as a way to take the edge off of my stress. And I just had a pattern of behavior that was really driving my success that was frankly a very dysfunctional and painful way to live a career. And so that's really, it's been a journey for sure, you know. So I would say that along that journey, I've done a number of different things on the personal development front to try to figure out how to be happier, to be less stressed. Somewhere along the line, I started writing down some stories from my childhood, felt like it was important to capture that, and ultimately came together with my co-author, Martha Finney, and together we created Healing at Work, which is a very different way of thinking about the workplace. Well, most of us think about the workplace as a place of stress, and I certainly did for a long time, and anxiety. What Martha and I do in the book is we teach people actually how to use the workplace as a laboratory for emotional healing. And the book really comes out of my own journey, as well as my journey with many executives and leaders and people through all those years working in those great companies. I've been very up close in having the opportunity and privilege to work with a lot of very complex people.
I can imagine.
Yeah, lots of stories. But it was all that journey that came together that culminated in the book. But probably originally where the book came from was in the early 2000s, I did a personal development program called Pathways to Successful Living. I was in the leadership course, and they did an exercise to help us get clear about our life purpose. And what I discovered in that session is that my life purpose is to teach self-acceptance to create a more joyful world. And I know that years later, the creation of the Healing at Work book was a manifestation of that purpose, at least a piece of that.
Well, let's go back into the early days of your career. I don't want to step over that. So it sounded like there was a high amount of anxiety happening there. And I'm curious whether you had a support mechanism. Did you have a group of people around you that recognized these things that were happening? And if so, what did that look like? And if not, were you able to build a support team, a group around you to be able to help you through that journey?
Well, I would say in the early days, I did not have a support group. And frankly, I was quite clueless and unconscious to how much things that happened to me when I was growing up, which we can talk more about in this podcast also. But I was really unaware about how much that past was influencing my present day career experience. And I don't think I ever showed that I was feeling stress and anxiety. In other words, if you looked at me from the outside, you would probably think that I was a high functioning, you know, generally happy person. And while I do think I've been an optimistic person my whole life, I was also managing a lot of, you know, impact of the inner critic voice on a regular basis. So early in the career, it didn't even dawn on me that this was happening. I just knew that I had this sense that I had to go in and prove myself on a regular basis. It wasn't until, you know, further down in the journey when I started to create what I ended up calling it my personal board of advisors. And I've been very fortunate to have people come into my life who have been teachers and mentors without whom I probably would not have made it as far as I made it. And it was almost an unintentional creation, but I found myself starting to reach out to people for advice, for guidance. I started to attend different programs and learn different things. And some of the people on my personal board of advisors I knew and others I didn't. You know, I just would sometimes wonder what famous people would think about different situations. But over time, that personal board of advisors really became like a safety net. And, you know, that I could call, you know, call a friend when I was getting into a situation in the corporate world that I had no clue how to navigate. And so over time, it became a very robust group of support people on my journey, for sure.
Yeah. Was there a moment that the imbalance between your outwardly career progression and the internal conflict grew to be too much? Was there a moment that you just realized that, hey, this isn't working?
Yeah, you know, there were actually a couple of moments. There was one very early in my career, and it was really sort of almost like a heads up that I didn't really pay attention to. I was working at an organization, and I had a boss. I was new. I was a new manager. I'd never been a manager. It was like I was 26 years old, I think. And I had a project that the team did really well with. We redesigned the performance management system. And I remember one day my boss called me into her office. Now, my boss had this little statue that she would sit on her desk. And on one side of the statue was Glinda the Good Witch. And on the flip side was the Wicked Witch of the West. And she would turn the statue every day, pointing out at whoever was sitting in her chair based on her mood. So if she was in a bad mood, the Wicked Witch would be facing you. If she was in a good mood, then the Good Witch would be facing you. So she called me into her office. The Wicked Witch was looking at me. I'm like, uh-oh. And she told me that my team had won this important recognition in the company. So I was very excited. And then she proceeded to tell me that I wasn't going to be given the cash award. And I was really confused. And I remember asking her, well, why? And her answers were very vague. I don't even remember what she said. But I left feeling despondent and, you know, frustrated. And as any young professional who doesn't really understand corporate dynamics and relationships, the next day I went and talked to her boss because I thought maybe he could give me insight. And he didn't even know. He didn't even know that I wasn't being given the award. Well, 2 days later, she calls me back in her office. The Wicked Witch is as far up on the edge of the desk as it could possibly be.
Oh, geez.
And in that moment, she went into a full-on rage, screaming at me and swearing and how dare you and just whatever. I triggered her for sure. But in that moment, my belief system kicked in and said, I deserve this. I deserve to get into trouble. It's my fault. I'm bad. you know, how dare I? And I'll never forget freezing. I mean, talk about fight, flight, freeze. I froze, sitting there, hot tears streaming down my face, embarrassed, and, you know, sort of limping out of her office. I don't even remember how I left. I just left. And then I resigned from the company because I was just mortified. That was actually an early warning sign that angry people are a huge trigger for me, because I had a dad who, this is not about, you know, judging or bashing parents. I think my dad did the best he could, but he had some major issues around uncontrollable rage fits. And so, you know, this is sort of an early sign of my reaction was so over the top. I completely shut down, completely blamed myself because of this angry, authoritative, very masculine woman who was screaming at me. And all I wanted to do was run away and hide under the bed, just like I did when my dad was screaming at my mom downstairs. So that was kind of an early, like, oh, geez, you know, what happened? But again, I blame myself. Fast forward years later, I was working in a team. I had my first really big HR job, my first vice president job. And I joined a team who were super talented, group of men, were creating huge value for the company. And I remember the first meeting with this group. You know, towards the end of the meeting, the president asked if there were any other questions. And I said, you know, I've got a couple of important HR topics to update you on. And one of the leaders stood up. He looked directly at me. He slammed his notebook shut and he walked out of the room before I could speak. And one of his colleagues followed him. And so again, you know, my interpretation was, I'm not good enough. I shouldn't be in this job. Who do I think I am? But that was actually a major turning point, because I was working with an amazing executive coach, and she had me do an exercise. And the exercise was to pick the worst of the nine. So these guys were tough on me. I mean, I have stories that would make you cry, given how tough they were on me. And I was in a place of judging them, blaming them, thinking they were disrespectful, and actually putting my resume together and getting ready to leave. And she had me do this exercise. She said, pick the worst. I picked four of them. And she said, okay, I want you to imagine that you're in their eyes looking at you. And if they had to describe you in the symbolic form of an animal, what animal would it be? And I burst out laughing, because I'm like, oh my God, I'm a little golden retriever puppy dog. I want them to pat me on the head, tell me what a good girl I am. And, you know, my proving myself was annoying. I was like, I wanted too much attention. And people-pleasing perfectionism, my two favorite behavior strategies, were actually backfiring. And then she had me get back in my own eyes and tell her, what were they, the four guys, what animals were they? And one was a grizzly bear, a gorilla, a wolf with long fangs, and a hyena, circling me laughing, but ready to go in for the kill. And what was so powerful about this experience, it was sort of a wake-up call, was realizing that actually none of this had to do with them. You know, I wanted to kind of externalize and didn't realize how much of a victim I was being by blaming them. But this experience of looking at how was I showing up, how was that working, and that little puppy dog was that needy, I'm not good enough, please pat me on the head, tell me you love me kind of, you know, symbol. And this exercise she did with me, her name's Toni Lynn Chinoy, by the way. I give her all the credit for this exercise. That exercise helped me realize that it wasn't about them, it was about me. And it was about my belief systems, it was about my behavior strategies, and the realization that I'm the one that had to think differently about how I was going to show up. So, you know, a couple of these stories, that, you know, it's been a, you know, 35-year journey to get to this point of creating healing at work. Well, not 35, because we published the book in 21. But all these moments on my own career that would send me into these great big spirals down into, you know, the pit of stress, anxiety, and worry. And sadly, a lot of overachieving perfectionists like me turned unhealthy habits to try to self-calm and self-regulate. And my choice was alcohol. And that was how I would take the edge off the fear, the hypervigilance, the anxiety related to what was happening to me in the workplace. So those were a couple of moments along the path. And it's taken a while to become conscious to how much my interpretations and interactions with people at work, when they weren't going well, were actually being fueled by things that happened when I was little. I didn't realize the connection. I was unconscious to that. So I didn't realize I was carrying this great big heavy load of an angry dad and never feeling like I was enough and all these, you know, kind of heavy rocks to go, oh, okay, wait a minute. Do I need to keep living my life like this? Which was what Martha and I created together, was realizing you don't have to do that. In fact, you can use workplace conflict as a catalyst for growth, because it's in those moments of conflict when we go right into our old behavior patterns. Mm. So anyway, that was a long answer to your question, but I've had so many stories along the path that have been sort of like, oh, what's going on here?
Well, I'll tell you. So the first extremely traumatic experience in terms of having your boss being the wicked witch and attacking you, and you immediately put your resume together. You didn't have an executive coach, I'm assuming, at that time.
I did not. I was like brand new in my career. Yep.
Yeah. So what did you do to heal or to at least bring yourself up to a point where you could build your confidence back after that episode?
Well, I don't think I really did, to tell you the truth. I felt embarrassed. Mm. I felt like I needed to leave. And I don't at that time, I didn't understand effective ways of managing these moments. My way of dealing with it was to drink. You know, that's not an effective strategy. You know, that was my strategy. Other people, it's too much food or gambling or too many gaming, whatever. You know, we turn to something to try to self-regulate. But, you know, my way of handling it was not a healthy way of handling it.
Yeah, absolutely not. Both physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. And yet you were able to pull yourself back up, put a resume together, and continue the career trajectory, right? As I talk to leaders and I hear stories like that, which frankly only, you know, possibly as little as 15, 20 years ago, there was the thought around leadership, this hierarchical sort of thought that really pervaded the ways that companies worked. And so in these 35 years, as you move closer to learning and gaining this wisdom, aside from alcohol, how did you find yourself navigating towards an executive coach or a group or a board of advisors? Because I can now think that there may be some of our listeners thinking, wow, I'd love to have a personal board of advisors. Where would I even start? So where did you realize that was something that was absolutely necessary?
Well, like I said, I think it was unconscious. It just happened. I mean, I didn't really plan it. For sure, along the way and along the path, I was seeking understanding about myself. So I attended Adult Children of Alcoholics support group in Chicago for 5 years. You know, a really powerful, positive 12-step experience to help me understand the impact of what I grew up with. And I also did therapy along the way. I had one amazing therapist who recommended that I go to a 7-day intensive program on, it was called Healing Trauma. And I remember thinking, what? Healing what? I didn't have trauma in my background. You know, I knew that I had an unhappy, angry dad, but I figured there were a lot worse childhoods than what I experienced. And what I learned in that trauma program was actually, you know, enlightening, which is trauma. We often think of trauma as like a major, you know, terrible thing that happens. In fact, there's a whole body of research around what are called the adverse childhood experiences, the ACEs. And so that's a major trauma, you know, emotional, physical, sexual abuse, neglect. I mean, there's a list of 10. And then they talked about little T trauma, which is chronic things that happen that aren't to the level of the major trauma, but chronically equate to a big trauma. And so for me, it was the never being able to predict my dad's anger. For me, that actually equated to a big trauma. So it was going through programs like this, becoming more aware, more conscious of some of the experiences I've had in the past and how it was affecting me today. And then eventually I ended up in AA myself when it's a long story. I don't want to get into all the details, but I finally, after I'd stopped drinking for many years, but had not gone to AA, I joined AA and started working the program myself with my sponsor. So this is a really healthy way to start managing some of the issues that I was wrestling with. And then professionally, I just started reaching out to people that I respected and would ask for, you know, hey, would it be possible for me to get 30 minutes? I'd love some coaching and advice. And what I found is that when you ask people if they would spend a short amount of time and offer advice, it makes them feel important, like, oh, she wants my advice. And, you know, so, you know, reaching out, and but not overdoing it, not over asking for, like, I'd like 2 hours of your time and advice. That's just not the way I did it. It was more in small amounts of time, just starting to get advice from people. And I was lucky too. There were people that reached out to me when I took my first head of HR job for Rockwell, which was a great company. I'd never been a head of HR. And one of the local chief HR officers, a woman named Mara Swan, who'd been an HR CHRO for way longer, I think 9 years she'd been in that role, she reached out to me and welcomed me to the community and said, call me anytime you need advice, anything I can do to support your path on this in this new job. And to this day, I still call Mara. Mara, this is happening. How do I need to think about it? You know, so it's a combination of thinking about different people in your circle or people you respect that you think you could learn from. And some of them were friends. I have a friend of mine who practices Eastern beliefs. And so I would call her for different pieces of advice. I didn't know anything about executive compensation when I took the first CHRO job. So I reached out to an old boss of mine and said, who do you know that can teach me? And coincidentally, he'd worked with a total rewards leader who was 20 minutes from my house, who I hired as a tutor. And so he became my executive coach tutor. So you just kind of think about, where are my gaps? And then, like I said, I was very lucky to have been supported with an executive coach through different parts of my career. And so if you ever get an opportunity, or if your company has an executive coach or coaching program, sometimes companies offer group coaching. Sometimes they offer executive coaching. Anytime you get an opportunity to do assessments at work, take advantage of that, because it gives you insight, helps you become more self-aware. And what I would learn, like, one of the people that did an assessment on me when I started at Kellogg's is a guy named Ken Wright. I loved the assessment process. I loved his interpretation. And Ken Wright became a key member of my board of advisors. To this day, 30 years later, we work together in supporting leaders understand who they are and what their opportunities are. And I can call Ken for any, you know, if there's something that I need to get some support on, I can call him for coaching. So it really depends on your interest and comfort to ask people, hey, would you spend a little time with me offering some advice?
Yes. What I'm hearing really is that where there's a thought around perhaps a lack of resources, there's never a lack of resourcefulness. And right. As you said, okay, Reaching out to those around you, you may think, I don't have resources to afford an executive coach, or my company just doesn't do things that way. And you'll find that, like you said, reaching out to people want to help others, and building that support system is just so key. And what I find very fascinating about your journey is this, that as you were going through yourself, your personal, your internal evolution, you were also moving through the career trajectory, moving up the corporate ladder, specifically in human resources, which is just so key in any business. I mean, we're talking about dealing with humans, and we're talking about really understanding the core of any organization, which is people. They're made up of people. And so as you're going through this journey of vulnerability, understanding yourself, did you find that allowed for the wisdom necessary in order for you to be in the position you're in now?
I absolutely think so, because what I know about myself is that when I was in a state of, you know, sort of this constant sense of hypervigilance, always scanning the horizon for trouble, it's a stressful place to be. And so as a leader, you know, there's a really powerful concept by a company called Sendelani, and the concept is called the shadow of the leader. And what it basically means is that however the leader is showing up at work, they are casting a shadow into their organization, and people will want to emulate that shadow. And so if I'm showing up as a stressed, anxious, hypervigilant leader who tends to be a perfectionist and people pleaser, that's going to be the shadow I cast into my organization. And so as I have been on this healing journey myself, as I've gotten much more comfortable with my issues, I've gotten much more comfortable talking about my past. I've developed such a better relationship with myself, which is ultimately, you know, the greatest gift we can give ourselves, that when I'm interacting with people, I understand how to manage emotional triggers. If I get triggered, I know it's my responsibility. It just happens to be this other person's giving me that opportunity to look at why I'm getting triggered. So I can stay grounded and balanced and calm in situations in the past I never could have. And so as a leader, I am very clear about where I can easily go off the tracks. I'm very upfront with my team. Perfectionists tend to be hard on themselves and hard on their teams. So I can tell my team, if you see me being too hard on you, you need to call it out, giving them permission. So absolutely, it's affected my leadership and my ability to not only hopefully create an environment for the team that works for me, but then when I'm interacting with other leaders within the company, which is a key part of my job, that they feel a sense of acceptance and non-judgment and support when they're coming to me for advice and perspective.
Mm. Did you find that as you were moving through the Fortune 500 landscape with more and more and more employees that you'd be responsible for, did you find that your evolution coincided with the general evolution of the thought of leadership? I've seen a tangible shift specifically since the pandemic, but even prior to the pandemic, where leaders have taken on servant leadership, putting themselves almost in a position where they're the Sherpa of the business, as opposed to the hierarchical dictatorial leader, right? Have you found that as you've kind of moved through these different organizations and they've gotten larger and larger, that things have shifted, the paradigm has shifted, or are you seeing that you are still somewhat unique in the way that you approach leadership and human interaction?
That's a really interesting and thoughtful question. I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I don't think I can correlate my success. And maybe there's some correlation. I definitely don't think there's causation of my own healing journey. I think part of the reason why I had great career success was because of my perfectionism and people pleasing, you know?
Right.
And, you know, I wasn't particularly good at setting boundaries around my personal life. So I worked all the time and I like it. I mean, I really love what I do. So I'm very results oriented. I care a lot about the people in the organization. So I always did my very best. Nobody would ever guess the drag I was carrying related to all these sort of emotional things going on unconsciously that were fueling some of my stress and anxiety. But I definitely think, I mean, what I can say for sure is that while I almost didn't publish the book back in 21 because I was afraid of personal judgment from family and I was afraid of professional judgment in my career, I was working with my coach, Celine DaCosta, who I engage personally because she's so powerful and high value. And she took me through an exercise and helped me realize that my why for writing the book was way bigger than my fear. And, you know, so that's what led me to write the book. But when I think about it, I'd already come to Applied Materials. So I came here in 2018. And, you know, so a lot of the healing and the insights that I'm sharing now were co-created with Martha during our journey of working together for 2.5 years during the pandemic. Mm. And I definitely think it's influenced how I show up as a leader today in my company and how I show up for other leaders in the company. But I wouldn't necessarily say it's correlated to career success. I think a lot of the dysfunctionality of my past was fueling my career success. I hate to say that, but I think it's true.
Well, I think there's a lot of corporate executives and leaders who have pushed down a lot of that trauma and who operate in a hypervigilant state quite often and don't realize the impact that has not only on those around them and their ability to really effectively communicate, but on being able to live in a place of of enjoyment and happiness and quality of life. And I think there's been throughout the years, there's been sort of a misconception that success, outwardly thought material success somehow equates to true quality of life. And as I've spoken with so many leaders, we've learned that some of the most outwardly successful leaders do not always have the most sort of comfort and enjoyment in their daily routines and lives. I'd like to move over to a little bit about, you mentioned the pandemic, but before we go there, you joined an organization, Applied Materials, 25,000 employees.
Yeah, it's actually 34,000 now.
My bad, 34,000 employees.
That's right. It's growing fast.
It sounds like it. And the question is, how do you ensure that this human element isn't lost in a workforce of 34,000 employees? I mean, how do you ensure that voices are heard?
Well, I'm very, very fortunate to be at Applied Materials because the company's culture is very special, and it was special long before I showed up. And it's really a testament to the leadership. Our CEO is a visionary. He's a strategic relationship ecosystem innovator. I don't know how else to explain it. And the people that work here, many people have worked here for many, many years. And in many respects, it's like a family. I mean, it's just relationships are deep. I'm an outsider because I came from outside the industry and I'm newer to the company, but it's a very special company that's very, very complex. And, you know, so when I think about the people element, I think the people element's always been a part of this company's personality. I think, you know, it's one of the reasons why I came. I saw this great opportunity with this amazing company. And all I've tried to do is to augment that that's already here. So there are extremely high quality leaders and teams that have worked together for years and a lot of new people that have joined. We've hired a lot of new people in the last few years. As you know, the semiconductor industry is a hot industry to be in.
Oh, yeah.
And it's only going to get bigger and better. So, you know, I think I've just come in. I've done a number of different things from an HR standpoint. I've helped clarify how we think about assessment, which is foundational to everything we do when we're making people decisions, whether it's selection for a job, determination of who goes on succession plans, how do we develop, how do we perform as management. Everything's about assessment. So I brought a model that's really powerful to help create clarity for everybody about that. From a culture standpoint, continuing to augment a culture that is about collaboration and inclusion. And we spent hours on that topic alone, but bringing some unique strategies from my past to help, again, augment the great organization that this already is. And then I'm on a mission with the great support of my CEO and others to bring healing at work. And my keynote, which I call When Your Past Gets in the Way of Your Future, to bring that to as many leaders and teams as I can. I was with one of our teams today based in India, Italy, Greece, and California, sharing with them that message. I've had an opportunity in my spare time with a small little virtual team to build a 6-week online digital self-study course to take the principles from the book and apply them in your life. And I make that available to anybody at the company. I give away my book to anybody in the company. And, you know, just continuing to keep people front and center.
That's extremely powerful. And you were mentioning that the pandemic of 2020 sounded like it supercharged a lot of this. And I can imagine that being what you were 2 years into your role there, and suddenly there was this massive shift to remote work. And since then, there's been all of these different, you know, technology changes between things like AI and different ways to be able to collaborate and co-create. Tell me a little bit about how you've like navigated those changes and those challenges and those different aspects of your role.
Well, it's one of the reasons why I love my role. It's never boring.
That's for sure.
It's never boring in HR. Well, I mean, it's been exciting and challenging and daunting and overwhelming and, you know, bonding. When you go through challenging times as a company, people come together. And in 2020, that's exactly what happened. You know, we were immediately deemed a critical infrastructure organization because we make chips. And so we immediately had to figure out, and it was all done in partnership with the executive team and the HR leadership team, of what's the right thing to do. And I'm super proud of our company. I think we navigated through that really well, always focused on health and safety as the number one priority, and trying to figure out ways to create health and safety. You know, it's almost like overnight we shifted into a whole different mode of how do we connect with one another. And, you know, a lot of our team were on site every single day because they were either in the labs with technology development, they were in our manufacturing facilities, our logistics organizations. So we had people that never went home and kept this company running. Those of us that could work virtually were asked to do that, obviously, to keep others on campus safe. And it was constantly, you know, evaluating what was happening and what we needed to do. And unlike many companies, I don't think Applied was unique in this. We set up a team. We had an excellent leader of the team that helped guide all the streams, customer, employees, all the different streams we needed to think about. And then each group was, you know, working together to figure out how do we adapt? What do we need to do to support people? And, you know, it was just an incredible experience for everybody. And the company continued to do well. And, you know, our CEO just kept everybody focused on our future and the possibilities and what we need to do for our customers. So that worked. And then as things have started to change, we work really closely as an executive leadership team to align on what's the right thing to do. And I think we've made really smart decisions through that. So it's one of the reasons why I love my job. It's working with the whole team, the executive team, the HR leadership team that's at the company, and figuring out and listening to everybody about what's the best solution. And again, one of the things our CEO does well is get input from lots of different perspectives so that we can make the best decision for the people.
It is an impactful journey. It is clear that you've successfully merged the world of high performance and well-being. And I'm curious, what would you say are some practical steps that our listeners can implement to bring this type of balance into their own career or into their own business?
Sure. I think a couple things to think about, very specific. Number one, living your life and career on what I call the unconscious wounded career path is not a healthy place to be. And when I say unconscious, we're unconscious to how much our past childhood experiences, the limiting beliefs we carry about ourselves, and old behavior strategies we use to try to create a sense of safety are often getting in the way of that self-acceptance and joy and better relationships with colleagues. So we have a choice. We can either stay on that unconscious career path where I was a long time, or we can step onto what I call the conscious healing career path. There's always going to be conflict at work. There's no question about that. We're human beings coming into the workplace, and 2/3 of us have dealt with some kind of significant trauma when we were little. And if we can become conscious that when we get emotionally triggered, to slow down and recognize that our reaction is probably fueled by things that happened in the past, then we can take different action than launching right into our old behavior. So what I mean by that, it's simple. It's just a 3-step process that I teach. I call it the rapid power reclaim. And thank you, Kyle Gray, for helping me with that idea. So the rapid power reclaim is a simple 3-step process when you're emotionally triggered to keep you on that conscious healing career path. Number one, the first thing you have to do is you have to create choice, because when you're emotionally triggered, your reptilian brain is kicked in and you're in fight, flight, or freeze. And the only way you get past that so you can create choice is you have to process the emotion. And there are a lot of techniques to do that. The key thing is sound, movement, and breath. If we had more time, I'd give you more examples. But that you've got to get that energy out of you, because if you keep it inside of you, you're going to stay stuck in a state of stress and anxiety. Step number one, create choice. And because what you're trying to do is move out of your reptilian brain into the prefrontal cortex where you can actually think logically and solve your problem. The second step of the rapid power reclaim to stay on the conscious healing career path is once you have processed that emotion out of you, then you can make the choice to elevate your action. So that's step 2, elevate your action. And all that means is to take time to think about what can I do in this situation that will elevate my action? In other words, rather than spiraling down into all the negativity, what can I do? And it could be very different depending on the situation. I can come back and give an example in a minute if you're interested. And then the third step of the rapid power reclaim is that once you've elevated your action, because you process the emotion by creating choice, the third step is celebrate and integrate. And those of us that grew up in dysfunctional past, perfectionist, we don't take time to celebrate anything. We're on to the next thing to prove ourselves. When we slow down, we celebrate looking at this situation, the conflict where we've been triggered, and we respond differently. That's actually an act of integrating it into our identity using the science of neuroplasticity that teaches us we can rewire the neural pathways in our brain. Celebrating is the act of focusing on positive, which is based on the positive research, positive psychology research that says when we focus on positive things, the quality of our life will improve and depression will decrease. And so celebrating to integrate is the third step. And that's how you stay on the conscious healing career path, using that simple three-step process, which I talk a lot more about in my course, how to do that. I've even got a mini course that just talks about this specifically. That will help you stay on that conscious healing career path and not coming from a place of emotional triggers from the past.
Mm. So this is wonderful. So what I heard was something very similar to some work I'm doing right now called Positive Intelligence by Shirzad Shamin, which really points at something very similar to that. And you mentioned sort of separating initially, like, you know, moving away from that amygdala hijack, that trigger that sends you into a saboteur mode where things are just sort of moving at a pace that's somewhat unmanageable, right? And then you mentioned elevate. So you separate, then now you're elevating to a space where you're in your sage mode, where you're in wisdom, when you're in gratefulness and understanding. And then what I heard was integrate and celebrate. Mm-hmm. So then you integrate those. And those three steps, how powerful. Now, do these happen right away, or do they take time to go through each one of these?
Well, I mean, there's first of all, if you're in a meeting and you get emotionally triggered, it's hard to do processing. You can't really do it with a bunch of people sitting around. So you might want to call a break. You might want to step out. But the actual amount of time doesn't necessarily take a lot. You know, the processing of emotion, energy inside of us, and again, there are different techniques to do that, can be a short, although you may have it out of you in a short amount of time. There have been other times where it may take longer, but we're not talking about a ton of time. And then sitting down and saying, all right, well, what am I going to do now to elevate my action? It's not rocket science. It's just, what can I do that's going to have a positive effect on what's happening? And then the hardest part for me was figuring out how to celebrate because I suck at it. you know, so I actually, my personal coach, Celine, said, you need to create a, you know, in your phone, in the notes, create a list of things that you can do to celebrate. You know, so going outside and standing in nature, taking a hot bath, sitting on the porch and just enjoying a sunset. You know, they're simple things, but I had to put a list together because I didn't have any automatic go-tos. It wasn't in my repertoire. So I don't think the rapid power reclaim needs to take a lot of time. The most important part is getting the emotion out of your body. I mean, I've got a friend, Sheila Darcy, who wrote a book. I'm not going to remember the exact name of it, but it's about her original name was Sketch Poetic. She uses the whole book's about sketching your emotion, getting it out of you into sketching. And it's not about being an artist. It's about releasing the energy. It's a beautiful book. But that's one way, is through movement of sketching the emotion, sketching anxiety, sketching fear, whatever it might be. There are other ways to do it. You know, sometimes I'll just go into a room. I got a plastic, you know, Amazon $5 baseball bat. I'll just hit it on the couch and scream and yell. One time I was trying to get energy out of me where I was upset about something, and I started singing. I don't know where it came from. And then I started doing somersaults. I mean, honestly, I have no idea where it came from. but getting it out of you, then you go back into your highest functioning adult self to be able to say, okay, I took care of that. What do I need to do now to really elevate how I'm going to respond? So it could be taking a break from a meeting. It could be at night you're getting more and more emotionally triggered. That's when to do this processing work, the creating choice. if you don't create choice, you stay stuck in an adrenaline warp and you're lost. And you can, I mean, it's not a great place to be. So yeah, it doesn't have to take a ton of time. And I've got other examples in my one mini course that I talk about, a really cool one, the three circle exercise, which I love.
Well, I would love to hear about all of it, and we don't have the time to go through them all, but those listening are, we're definitely going to point them at the course because this sounds like some really valuable information that people can use.
Thank you.
In terms of time management, now you're somebody who has a, you know, some would call a demanding role. Quite a few people are, you're responsible for, and you're an author and you have all of these different activities. And I'm wondering, what do you do to manage your time effectively? Can you share some tips with our audience about that?
Yes. And so first of all, previously, before I tell you what changed it, I would say I would get up early, do my exercise, and basically run through my day and try to get as much done as possible. Yeah. All right. So that, and you know, I would think I need gas, but do I really need gas? Well, maybe I'll get it tomorrow. I was always trying to be efficient with every minute of my day. And at the end of the day, I'd be frustrated because I hadn't done something that I wanted to, or I'd gotten into a project and it took way longer than I expected. Then I'd be mad. And that's not a great place to be. So then I was introduced to a book that I highly recommend called 4,000 Weeks. 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman. And basically what he says in the book, and it's wonderful, it's so good, I'm listening to it a second time. He says, if you live to age 80, you only have 4,000 weeks of your life. How do you want to use those 4,000 weeks? Now, I'm going to be 60 this year, so I'm thinking that means maybe I have 1,000 weeks. my weeks are getting shorter. And in his book, he talked about how he was a time management productivity expert, but he realized that the more productive you become, the busier you become, because then you're just doing other things. And the whole point of his book, but he does it so beautifully, is to say, look, you're never going to get it all done. You got 4,000 weeks. You better figure out what matters most to you and focus on that. And if you're going into a project, you can expect it's going to take double the time, so just be ready for that. And it's totally changed my whole life. I go through my day now, I think I'm not going to rush. I'm not going to get upset if my technology is not working and it takes me 4 hours to fix it. It's part of it's a phenomenon he talks about. But that book has changed my life related to time.
Oh, wow. And what was the name of the book again?
4,000 Weeks.
4,000 weeks. And when you break down your life into weeks that way, it doesn't seem like a lot of time, does it?
Not. And that's what he said in the front of the book. He started asking people, how many weeks do you have if you live to age 80? And some people are like, you know, 200,000. And they're coming up with crazy numbers. It's 4,000 weeks. And so what that did for me is it helped me focus on my real priorities. So in the past, if I get into my cadence at work, you know, I didn't want anything personal to bother me. Now, like this happened, I don't know, maybe a month ago, my youngest son called up. He's like, Mom, I really need help on my resume. And I cleared my afternoon, 2 hours to work on his resume with him. Because all that matters to me is making sure that I'm taking care of my family and that they feel loved. That is one of my most important priorities. And while I greatly value work and work is a huge priority for me because I care very deeply about it, in that moment, I made the space for Sam. I would not have done that in the past before reading Oliver's book.
And I'll add that by you making the space for yourself, it allowed you to be able to make the space for Sam.
Absolutely.
And those in your life. And, you know, you mentioned something sort of an artistic side in terms of you know, an importance there. You kind of skipped over that you have an exercise routine in the morning, it sounds like, that you've had for a while. So I'm sure that's a pillar there.
It is.
But talk to me a little bit about outside of, you know, the, you know, getting things done in the world, what is it that you do? Like, what are some things that bring you joy and help you unwind and sort of sprinkle that love into your daily life?
Well, my passion, which I do mainly on the weekends, is I'm an equestrian, a competitive equestrian. And I'm at the most wonderful stable of my life. I have the most amazing trainer and trainers. The people in the barn are, I said barn, not bar. Be clear. The people are, it's a great community. It's just a great positive. I have the most amazing horses. It's outdoors and I live for it. That is my passion.
Mm. And do you find yourself building deep connections with the animals?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yep, absolutely. Yep. I have been very blessed with some very special horses. Mm. And, you know, there are ups and downs with injuries with horses, and it's been kind of a tough year. But it's just a very connected spiritual experience. Horses are very spiritual animals. Mm. And being in nature and galloping around on a horse and jumping jumps with friends, it doesn't get much better than that.
No, it doesn't.
Really fun. I know. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see it on your face. You have this amazing smile as you're talking about that. And well, I want to thank you so much for sharing in such a vulnerable way what you've been up to. And for those that are interested, whether they're business leaders, HR executives, or just people that are very curious about ways to be able to heal at work and be able to move into a less hypervigilant state and a state of the ability to sort of manifest their purpose.
Mm-hmm.
What would you recommend in terms of your own books, your own workshops, or places that, you know, resources that people can check out?
Yeah. I mean, my personal website is healingatwork.com. So I have a lot mm-hmm. of material out there. The course information's out there, but since this is a special opportunity, I'll get you a discount code on my courses. So anybody who's listening who wants to do a course, I'm going to make a discount available. Healingatwork.com has all the details. My Susan J. Schmidt Winchester LinkedIn also has a lot of information. You can subscribe to my newsletter. I send out a lot of content. And also, if you wanted to be on my global community email list and get regular messages from me, which are really all about supporting people in their careers and workplaces, you can also send your email to me. I think on my website, susan@healingatwork.com, and I'm happy to add you to the global community where you'll get regular messaging from me.
Hmm. Well, thank you for all you do. You're clearly a supportive person for not only the businesses that you're a part of, but for your family. And really the work that you do causes a ripple throughout. And so thank you so much for that. We appreciate that. Healingatwork.com, Susan Winchester. She has a journey through the corporate world that is, I'm sure we just touched on a bit of it, but what's very interesting is that personal journey inward and how that's allowed you to find purpose and to be able to really cause impact in the world, not just human resources, but human beings in general.
Yes.
And wellness.
Exactly.
Thank you for that.
Thanks, Alex.
Yes, this was great. And I'm looking forward to checking out your website and being able to refer some of those resources to people in my community as well.
That's great. Well, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to your community. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for coming into the lounge. You are a true alchemist.
Thank you.